Can't buy me love, love, can't buy me love, I'll buy you diamond ring.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Let's face it, Valentine's Day is a holiday built for consumption. That may sound a bit of a buzzkill, but there is loads of research activity connecting our romantic ideals and more base human motivations to our decisions to spend and save, mostly spend. Dr. Marina Adshade teaches economics at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and she hit a nerve there in 2008 when she launched an undergraduate course called The Economics of Sex and Love. It was an instant hit among students and led to the launch of the Dollars and Sex blog, which is now the title of a book. It uses market research and economic analysis on matters of the heart and other anatomical parts. Dr. Marina Adshade is with us. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me today.
So that's quite a calculated decision, putting sex in a college course title. You creating demand there?
It's funny. When I first launched the course, people said to me, you know, your students could be very disappointed when they get into the classroom and they realize that they're not really being taught about sex and love. They're really just being force-fed economics with a slightly different, sexier kind of package. But, of course, that's not true at all. That's exactly what I teach. And so my classroom was full every day, and my students always left buzzing with conversation about the topics that we covered in the course, because there is so much out there in terms of economic research and theory that we can apply to matters of the heart and, as you say, other body parts.
Well, that's what's interesting to me, you know, that economics actually looks at how we actually behave, I think, rather than how we should. And it seems like a lot of your research supports that. Give us an example of viewing love and sex through an economic lens that gives us a kind of sobering vision of it.
I think this is the real value of the approach. You know, I'm an economist. I always love the economic approach. But so much of what we talk about today is caged through a lens of morality or political views, whereas economists have a different approach because we only rely on outcomes that we can actually measure. And when you have measurable outcomes, it kind of allows you to strip away the rest and to see how people actually behave in their relationships. And so we get a better perspective, but it's a clearer perspective than you would get than if you were, you know, ignoring all the data that's out there. So there's so many examples, but I think for Valentine's Day, this is daytime radio, so I'm not sure how much I should
say. Exactly, daytime radio, family hour.
Okay, so there's research that's been done on happiness, whether or not people who are married are happier, or people who are single are happier, particularly in terms of their physical relationships that they have with their partners. And that's really interesting because the research uses a huge data set from the U.S. with, I think there's 6,000 people that were surveyed, and they find that despite this perception that single people have more fun, it's actually not true, is that married people actually have relationships that are far more satisfying and that make them happier.
Well, these are some of the thorniest things, of course, we come to in relationships, monogamy, promiscuity. Now, there are actual ways that you go through calculating the cost of being faithful or unfaithful. Can you give us an example of some research that shed some light on that for us?
Yeah, we have the thing about infidelity is that it's very difficult to measure because of the reluctance of people who are unfaithful to speak to researchers and provide that evidence. But we're getting better and better data all the time, mostly because people are opening up a little bit more when they're surveyed. And so we can look at things like the relationship between income and infidelity. We have this perception because we hear all the time in the news about the wealthy and powerful people who are cheating on their wives, and this gives us a perception that wealthy men are more likely to cheat than are men who have lower incomes, and the data just doesn't support that at all. Actually, the bottom line is that income and infidelity have very little to do with each other when it comes to men, but it's with women that you see the real trend, is that women who are higher income women are far less likely to be unfaithful than lower income women. So that's the type of data, the way we can use data to dispel some of these myths that we have in our society that we get just from, you know, observing everyday life.
There's also research on whether promiscuity actually makes nations rich. Give us more on that, if you would.
Well, you know, that's that. I mean, that theory is basically not that promiscuity makes nations rich. It's just the same thing that makes a nation rich makes people more liberated to act on their sexual desires. And, you know, there's a long history in economics of looking at institutions and the way that economies grow. When we know that economies where people have a lot of personal freedoms, those countries grow quickly because people use those personal freedoms to advance the betterment of society. For example, you know, coming up with new technologies and new ideas, ways of doing things. But those same type of personal freedoms lead to, you know, more personal freedoms in terms of your own behavior. And so I think they're very closely tied to each other, the idea that I'm free to behave, act on my sexual impulses, and I'm free to behave in ways that are good for society as a whole.
So richest nation in terms of promiscuity and wealth, what was it, Finland?
So the most promiscuous, actually the Scandinavian countries in general are across the board the most promiscuous. In fact, the Norway's Board of Tourism got in trouble a couple of years ago because they had a tourism ad in which they basically just portrayed the women there as being really quite promiscuous and saying, come visit our country, our women are really easy.
And Dr. Marina Adshage is with us. She's an economics professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. She's also the author of the Dollars and Sex blog and a new book. It's called Dollars and Sex, and it's about looking at our relationship and otherwise behaviors through an economic framework. Well, of course, online dating is the way that a lot of people know each other now or get together. You have done some or looked at some research about, you know, whether it actually creates a thin market, online dating. But one of the things I also found very interesting, that research that less attractive people have more deceptive online profiles. How then, Marina, does the buyer beware?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's not really that surprising that less attractive people have more deceptive profiles, not because I think that less attractive people are more prone to lying. It's just that they stay on the market for longer. So maybe when they first put up their profile, maybe they were really honest. But over time, as they sit on the market and they don't find a mate, the impulse is to go in there and to edit, to take off a few pounds, make yourself a little taller, you know, make yourself a little bit better educated. And so I think that's the reason why you have this relationship between less attractive and more deceptive. And so really maybe what people should look at when they're online is how long people have been searching. Because I really do think that that's the mechanism there. If somebody's been on online dating for 2 years, you know, you should maybe be wondering about the accuracy of their profile because of the incentive to go in there and you know, sweeten it up a little bit.
Well, maybe they just haven't found the right person. And that's a question for you. For Marina, you admit that you haven't had a relationship in some time.
So
is any of this...
Thanks for talking to me today, because, you know, if I wasn't for...
Happy
for me,
Valentine's Day, Marina.
I would have no Valentine's Day. This is like my national holiday.
Well, I wonder, is any of this, all of this information, does that give you any actual help or knowledge for finding a mate?
It does. You know, it makes me, obviously, I've spent a tremendous amount of time thinking about this. And a lot of there's a lot of stories in the book. There's a lot of narrative. Some of the stories are very personal stories of mine. So you can't write a book like that. And I wrote the book in Paris. I spent a year in Paris writing the book. So
that's romantic.
It's impossible not to think about your own love life under those circumstances. So I think that really what, for me personally, what the book did is it gave me an opportunity for introspection. And I think that the readers will get the same thing, too. The book is not a self-help guide on how to find somebody online or anything along those lines, but really just to, you know, provide some clarity of thinking about your own choices and your own decisions that you make in life when it comes to matters of the heart.
And it's really fun as well. Marina, happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you.
And
thank
you
for having me.
Dr. Marina Adshage, economic professor at the University of British Columbia. She's also author of the Dollars and Sex book and the very popular Dollars and Sex blog. Don't forget, you can, of course, follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Elizabeth Gilbert's memoir, Eat, Pray, Love, has added a great deal of tourism dollars to the GDPs of Italy and Indonesia and India. The very public discovery of love does not mean that marriage necessarily followed. We're going to hear about her struggle to commit when word of mouth continues.